The following edition of Bloomberg's Wall Street Week was recorded ahead of the Thanksgiving holiday.
This is Bloomberg Wall Street Week.
Markets shrug off higher consumer prices. The economy is in the process of rebounding. Will the Federal Reserve have its own digital currency?
The financial stories that shape our world.
Many people think the yields are just going to keep marching up. We have more spending coming out of Congress. One of the big questions, I think, on investors' minds, inflation.
Through the eyes of the most influential voices.
Larry Summers, the former Treasury Secretary. Brian Moynihan of Bank of America. Wells Fargo CEO Charlie Scharf.
Bloomberg Wall Street Week with David Westin from Bloomberg Radio.
Not so new leadership for the Fed. Oil from strategic reserves and the holiday shopping season gets underway. This is Bloomberg Wall Street Week. I'm David Westin. It was a shortened holiday trading week in the United States, but that didn't mean we wanted for news, as President Biden finally told us who he wants to be running the Fed.
I'm nominating Jerome Powell for a second term as chair of the Federal Reserve. And I'm nominating Lael Brainard to take the position as vice chair of the Federal Reserve.
And then the president said he wants to help us all out at the gas pump by releasing some petroleum reserves. Although initial reaction was probably not exactly what he wanted. And then with the threat of a further Russian invasion of Ukraine, described by Richard Haass of the Council on Foreign Relations.
Whether this is simply a show of force in order to muscle Ukraine, to persuade the government there, say, not to move closer to the West, or whether this is the prelude to an intervention in which they would take over enormous parts of the country, conceivably even the capital. I don't rule anything out at this point.
And then, just before that Thanksgiving holiday, a massive dump of economic data in the United States showing strong spending, continued inflation, and overall economic growth, as summarized by Tiffany Wilding of PIMCO.
We saw a pretty decent reacceleration in economic activity in October. So I think that was confirmed, as you mentioned, by the consumption data. You know, so I think overall the data was quite good, raised our own forecast for growth for the fourth quarter, and certainly good news, for growth moving forward.
All of which left the markets with a good deal to chew on this week, and the tech sector really didn't like it very much because we had this prospect of higher rates coming along. So we thought we'd take this shortened week, this holiday week, to reflect a little more broadly for investors on what the phenomena are that we're facing. And there's no one better to do that than Gillian Tett. She is the editor at large for the U.S. as well as head of the editorial board at the Financial Times. She's also an author of a very important book called Anthrovision. Gillian, it's great to have you back with us. Thank you for joining us. Let's apply some of your anthropology, if you could, as well as your financial acumen, to what we saw this week with the appointment, reappointment of Jay Powell and the appointment of Lael Brainard as vice chair. And one of the things I'm curious about is one of the biggest issues we have in this country right now is inflation. And yet in the appointment, we didn't hear President Biden say much about that at all. Is the Fed really, should it be that independent from what's going on in the country?
Well, the reason you didn't hear President Biden say very much about inflation is because the Federal Reserve right now is in an absolutely nightmarishly difficult position. Now, the immediate reason for that is that it has these twin goals of low employment and keeping inflation under control as well. But it's very likely that in the coming months, we're going to see inflation spiral out of control while employment still isn't anywhere near what the Fed wants. So there's a big cognitive dissonance there about what on earth the Federal Reserve is going to do about that. Plus, of course, the fact that you've got asset price inflation that's been going up and up and up and up, and yet somehow the Fed only looks at consumer price inflation, which just doesn't make much sense in terms of how people live their lives. But the other big issue is that the Federal Reserve has sort of convinced us in recent years that it's almost like this sort of high priest of the American economy, where it has these seemingly magical powers and this continuity to keep the show on the road, no matter what happens in politics. And, you know, the Fed leaders are there for a lot longer than many other politicians. And it's created this aura of omnipotence. And yet the reality is that if you look at what's happening right now, there's not a lot the Fed can actually do about inflation because it's been driven to a large degree by supply chain problems, by the fact you've just had this massive fiscal boost. So the Fed's simultaneously trying to convince us that it has control over inflation, but the reality is it probably doesn't. And on top of that, you have the fact that, you know, the Fed pretends that it's somehow changing the economy and the financial system by moving the price of money by minute degrees or changing how it buys bonds. But in reality, what's really driving sentiment is what it says It's verbal intervention. You might even call it voodoo. So there's a lot of cognitive dissonance in the way that we see the Fed at the moment. And I think for that reason, it's going to have a tough time in the months ahead.
Well, I wonder, Jillian, how much of the Fed's power is really derived from its credibility and the fact that we believe in it, we trust it for one reason or another. Do we really trust an institution to have that much power if they don't listen to us at some general level? And specifically, isn't the appointment process that we just saw this week with President Biden, isn't it that one limited way to have some influence over the Fed?
Absolutely. I mean, what's been fascinating this week is you've seen Congress pushing for much greater say on the part of the progressives in terms of who gets appointed. But the reality is that there's a lot of sort of almost mystical magic around the Fed. It's a bit like the priest in medieval Catholic Church who spoke Latin and the congregation didn't, but the congregation relied on the priest to provide the blessings. I mean, most people don't actually understand what the Fed's doing and what it says most of the time. And of course, it's not elected. Again, that's another point of cognitive dissonance, because so much of the American self-perception is driven by this concept of democracy and being accountable, and the Fed's independent. So I think, you know, there are a lot of questions about the way that the Fed maintains its credibility going forward. The fact that central banks have marble pillars or granite pillars or hefty buildings is no accident. It symbolizes their sense of permanence. But the reality is that, you know, anthropologists know that every society assumes the way that they live at the moment is normal and inevitable and permanent. And that's just not the case.
Okay, Jillian, it's always great to have you on Wall Street Week. Thank you so much. That's Jillian Tett of the Financial Times.
Thank you.
Coming up, it's the holiday season, which means, of course, shopping. We talk retail sales with a true expert, Jerry Storch, longtime head of Toys R Us, about what to expect this year in retail. That's next on Wall Street Week on Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Wall Street Week with David Westin from Bloomberg Radio.
It is holiday time, and that means for all of us a time to go out and get those gifts for everyone. And we thought it would be a good time to review where we are on the retail sector right now, particularly with Black Friday in the United States happening right after Thanksgiving, which is the official start for the season. And when it comes to retail, there's no one better to talk to than Jerry Storch. He, of course, is the longtime chairman and CEO of Toys R Us. He is now the CEO of Storch Advisors. So, Jerry, thank you so much for being with us. Let's start with the most basic question. We hope we're kind of coming out of the pandemic. Where is retail in recovery from what the pandemic did to it?
Look, overall, we're more than back. We're beyond any expectations. Sales are actually at unprecedented levels. This really began last spring, and sales have been accelerating ever since. We've heard all kinds of stories about, slowing down over the summer because of Delta or this or that. The supply chain was scaring people, inflation, all the rest. But when you look at a two-year stack in sales, that is, compare sales today to sales 2 years ago before the pandemic, they've been running up more than 20%. It was 18% in June, 19% in July, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, up 22% versus 2 years ago in the most recent sales report, which covered October. 22% in 2 years. And even the normal best of times, that number should be half of that. So sales are actually booming, and I would expect holiday sales to be up double digits versus last year.
How even is the recovery? Are there some parts of the retail sector doing better than others?
Well, there are certainly winners and losers, as there always are. The winners are those that were well positioned before the pandemic, and a few companies that are having kind of a dead cat bounce based on pent-up demand. So the biggest winners are Walmart, Target, Home Depot, Lowe's, Amazon, Costco, giant retailers with broad assortments, the ability to navigate this environment, to get those goods on the floor, and consumers have been flocking both to the physical stores for these companies and to their websites. So they continue to grow at tremendous rates. A few other companies have done well during the fall that you might not normally expect strategically to be that well positioned. People like a Macy's or a Dillard's or a Kohl's, you know, companies with strong apparel businesses or department stores. But I warn you, the pandemic does not fix a broken strategy. And so some of what you're seeing here is that people were not buying clothing during the pandemic. Now they're coming out and they're buying those goods. Those are not long-term good bets. They have to revolutionize their business model to succeed. That's quite different from the first companies I mentioned, who already have a winning business model and are just putting their foot on the accelerator and growing even faster. No discussion of retail will be complete without mentioning Amazon. I'm sorry, I just have to go there, right? And Amazon stock hasn't done very much this year. And in some ways, I think that's a huge opportunity because they continue to be the class act of the dominant growth segment in retail, which is e-commerce. So, you know, whatever you may think about Amazon one way or the other, or back to the politicians, everyone else trying to muck around their business, they are the only one who can deliver consistently, no matter what happens to everyone else's supply chain.
I want to come back to Amazon. Before that, just let me pick up on something you said before. 2-3 years ago, I had the impression that department stores, the general department stores, were definitely in decline. Has this changed that at all, or will they remain in decline apart from what you call the dead cat bounce?
Well, I think over the long term, they're still in decline. In the short term, they've picked up quite nicely. But keep in mind, they've lost such massive amounts of market share that when you look at the overall retail sales pie, they're actually kind of irrelevant already. The game's almost over. You know, Sears is gone. Penny's went bankrupt. They're just a shadow of what they used to be. You know, you've got just a few, Lord & Taylor and Baker. We just got a few of them left. And those have not been growing significantly. I mentioned that 2-year stack in growth that's up more than 20% for retail sales as a whole. The department stores are struggling that same 2 years to get over 10% growth, despite the fact that no one was even buying anything from these stores. They were steeply negative last year. So I don't see this as a long-term win. They will tell you, oh, look, it proves our strategies are working. You know, Macy's will say, look, it's just like what we did in Polaris, Ohio, you know, our model store. It's working everywhere now. Well, I think they're fooling, you know, almost no one but themselves when they say that, because that isn't going to fix anything. To fix a business like that, you have to change who you are to the consumer. And let's be honest, today's millennials do not want to shop where their grandparents shop. They don't want to go to a department store. There has to be more fundamental change.
Jerry, let's go back to Amazon. As you say, you can't have a talk about retail sales these days without talking about Amazon. And I'd like a sense of two market shares. One is e-commerce versus bricks and mortar. What's going on there? Is that continuing? Is e-commerce continuing to grow as a part of the pie overall? And secondly, Amazon within the e-commerce section.
Yeah, you have to look at it again over that 2-year basis, because what we saw with e-commerce sales, let me start there, is that they mushroomed last year during the pandemic, including key times like the holiday period when there was still a lot of lockdowns. You remember that second wave that came last holiday. So people were forced online. And you saw essentially a couple of years of growth in that 1 year. And then people say, oh, look, it's slowing down now. It's not so much up year over year, but it's still up versus that enormous multi-year growth that occurred. So that 20% fall off retail, it's 40% for e-commerce. So it's grown 40% in 2 years. And there's still growth over last year in that 40% number. So it's still growing quite nicely. Thank you very much. It's just the people have a choice now to go to bricks and mortar retailing. And in fact, they're doing that. And so you see traffic counts up in bricks and mortar stores versus last year. And so of course, during this period, bricks and mortar is gaining back some of that sort of unsustainable accelerated growth in e-commerce share that took place during the pandemic period. But over any kind of reasonable time frame, like that 2-year time frame, bricks and mortar is still losing share overall to e-commerce. And the same thing is true of Amazon. While certainly some of its competitors have gained, if you look at what some of the competitors are doing, they're utilizing their omni-channel, or what I call the all-channel model, to drive customers to the stores and do in-store pickup. You know, I do that a lot with groceries at Walmart, which is the main growth, by the way, in Walmart's e-commerce has been grocery pickup in the store. So this hybrid model has been where they're growing, which is smart and right and what they need to do, because it's leveraging their stores for a competitive advantage versus Amazon, which does work in something that's perishable like groceries. But overall, if you really take a look at the big guys versus Amazon, they're all a fraction of Amazon's size. You know, Walmart is somewhere between 10 and 15% of Amazon's size online. So it's really Amazon versus Amazon online. Everyone else is picking up some pieces and building a complex all-channel model. Great model, you know, the right model for them. And some of them, the winners I mentioned, are going to do just fine. You know, again, Walmart, Target, you know, Home Depot, Lowe's, Costco. These companies are going to do great, you know, with that hybrid model. But it doesn't mean Amazon is quaking in its boots that they're going to lose out in e-commerce to these folks.
As I say, when it comes to retailers, nobody we want to talk to more than Jerry Storch. Thank you so much, Jerry. He is the CEO of Storch Advisors. Coming up, we talk with special contributor Larry Summers about the future of the Fed now that we know who will be leading it. That's next on Wall Street Week on Bloomberg.
The following edition of Bloomberg's Wall Street Week was recorded ahead of the Thanksgiving holiday.
This is Bloomberg Wall Street Week with David Westin from Bloomberg Radio.
I'm nominating Jerome Powell for a second term as chair of the Federal Reserve. And I'm nominating Lael Brainard to take the position as vice chair of the Federal Reserve. At this moment, both enormous potential and enormous uncertainty for our economy, we need stability and independence at the Federal Reserve. Jay has proven the independence that I value in the federal chair, in the Fed chair.
One of those who expressed some support for President Biden's decision was Larry Summers, our very own special contributor here on Wall Street Week, former Treasury Secretary, of course, now with Harvard. So, Larry, thanks so much for being back with us. Give us what you took away from this announcement and what was said around the announcement, perhaps even as important as the announcement itself.
So I think the president made a good choice. Jay Powell, in the fullness of it all, has done an excellent job at the Fed. Lael Brainard is an experienced and capable monetary policy operator. I think it's a good team. It's a team that'll have some creative tension in areas like regulation, in areas like the environment, but I think it's a very good team at the helm of the Fed, and I was glad to see the president's choice. I was equally glad to see what the president said in announcing them, what Chairman Powell said, what nominated Vice Chair Brainard said, because they all recognized what has been true for some time, that overheating and inflation are right now the central macroeconomic problems facing the American economy. And there was no good outcome for the American population, for the American middle class that is so dear to President Biden, without taking steps to get inflation under control. And I think that the rhetoric you saw from Chairman Powell and Vice Chair Brainard portends a new era here for the Fed. I think the question the Fed is now managing is not, do we have an overheating problem? Can we bet with Team Transitory? They know we do have an overheating problem and that they can't place their bet with Team Transitory. They've got a new problem, and it's a very complicated one, and I very much hope they'll be very thoughtful about it because there are no easy answers. The new problem is, how do you land this economy softly? That got corroborated by the numbers we saw. The PCE deflator was very strong. Even more important, the income and spending numbers were stronger than we expected. The revision of the national accounts revised upwards how much income consumers had. That means it revised upwards how much pent-up savings ready to spend they have. So all the numbers are pointing towards a lot of strength. All the numbers are pointing towards limited capacity. You know, we've been saying for a long time now that vacancies are record highs, quits are record highs. We got another number in that direction. Unemployment insurance claims lowest since 1969. And of course, we've got a lot more people than we did then. So that makes it an even stronger statement. So we're looking at a challenge of slowing an overheating economy. And we know from the research of a number of people that that's a very difficult thing for a central bank to do. It's particularly difficult when, frankly, it's late to the party to recognize the overheating, and when they have only an instrument, a monetary policy, that works quite slowly through the economy with lags of 9 months to a year. The Fed very foolishly asserted that it wouldn't ever start raising monetary policy until we were at full employment, which, given the lags, was much too strong a statement. And they're going to have to figure out how to maneuver within their framework, which when it was put forward didn't contemplate anything like this moment, to provide the necessary gradual restraint. If they overdo it on restraint, the economy could easily tip over, especially given how much euphoria there is built into markets. So it's not going to be an easy set of maneuvers for the Fed. But they now, I think, recognize what they're dealing with in a way that as recently as a couple months ago in Jackson Hole, they did not.
Okay, Larry, we're going to ask you to stay with us if you would, please, because as important as that monetary policy is and the Federal Reserve, there are also issues on the fiscal side, and there's a question whether the Biden administration needs to make something of a mid-course correction on fiscal policy. We're going to ask Larry Summers, our special contributor on Wall Street Week, coming up. That's coming up next on Wall Street Week on Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Wall Street Week with David Westin from Bloomberg Radio.
We've talked about the Fed and monetary policy. Let's turn now to fiscal policy. The Biden administration now, at the end of its first year, must be thinking a little bit about whether there are any mid-course corrections it might make, specifically on the question of inflation that Larry Summers has talked so often about. Larry Summers, our special contributor, has remained with us. So, Larry, what about what the administration could do? Put aside the Fed. What the administration could do on the front of inflation?
So, look, I think we need to be honest and we need to recognize that the main action, the overwhelming action, is with monetary policy, and it's with the overall posture of fiscal policy. The overall posture of fiscal policy has been substantially set, unfortunately set, by the mistakenly large fiscal stimulus that was enacted at the beginning of 2021. The administration's moving towards doing the right things. The SPRO release was probably a constructive step. But as we saw, they released the SPRO, and immediately after the SPRO release, the price of oil actually went up. That's because the release was a little smaller than many people expected. It's because, unlike after Libya, the Europeans didn't join in the SPRO release. It's because the whole thing had been widely telegraphed for the last few weeks. So probably if this whole SPRO thing had not happened, oil would be a few dollars higher, but we've kind of done it, and we are where we are. I think the administration should do what it can to encourage oil supply in the United States, but I think it's mostly developments in capital markets, not public policies, that are driving where we are on oil.
I was just going to say, just to be clear, SPRO is the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. For some people who aren't as conversant with this as you are. But you were going to say low-hanging fruit. I was going to ask about other possible regulatory relief, such as tariff relief, for example.
So I think the administration does need to find its way to more rapid action on tariffs. I think it's plausible that they could take up to 0.5%, maybe even 1%, out of the inflation rate over the next 18 months. With properly strategic tariff reform, but that's going to require them to adopt a more forward-looking attitude towards trade than they have already. I think if they could emphasize buy cheap rather than buy America, that would be constructive as well. I think as they look at their various regulatory agendas, they need to think about which ones are imposing costs on business and be careful. These are all steps that I think are significant, but they're not ultimately what is going to determine the outcome. And while I've tried to speak to them, I think it's very important not to divert attention from the central issue, which is the management of demand and the recognition of overheating. The truth is that we don't have slack in our labor market today. And there isn't room for more demand to employ more people without unsustainable inflation. And that's, I wish it was otherwise. The people who say that more demand does enormously good things for disadvantaged people are absolutely correct, but you have to do things that are sustainable if you want them to be sustained. And we're in the unsustainable place right now in terms of how hard we're pushing and pressing the economy.
Larry, let me ask about one other regulatory initiative potentially. We've heard President Biden more than once say he wants the FTC to look into the oil companies, whether they're gouging right now, if I can put it that way, because the price of oil going down has not been reflected at the pump. There are reports from Bloomberg and elsewhere that perhaps the administration is thinking about a broader ranging use of antitrust and perhaps other laws and regulations to really go after people that they think are passing along price increases. Does that make sense?
Look, we need stricter antitrust enforcement in America. One of the things I'm encouraged by about the Biden administration is that they're going to bring us stricter enforcement of the antitrust law in America. That is a very important thing. Where there are abuses, they should be corrected. If anybody thinks that gouging is an important cause of our current inflation, they are dead wrong. And a policy approach to inflation that put some theory of gouging or exploitation or bad corporate behavior at the center of policy would be economic ivermectin. It would be a dangerous and false diagnosis and a prescription for a very real and serious problem. I think the administration won't go that way. I certainly hope it will not go that way. And if it does, it will be a very dangerous sign that they are overly responsive to the hard Democratic left, which I have to say I think has been the source of many of their difficulties.
Larry, when we turn back next week to the Build Back Better plan, we'll have Congress back in session. They're going to be negotiating it some more. You said you don't think imbalance is that bad on the inflation front. You think there are a lot of good things in there. But what could be done to improve it from your point of view?
Let me be very clear. If I had to vote up or down on it, I would definitely vote up. Let me be equally clear that I think over time it will make substantial contributions to making American society both richer and fairer and more sustainable in its environmental impacts. That said, I'd be more comfortable with the measure, David, if there wasn't quite as much fiscal stimulus in the first few years. And I think there's an easy way to achieve that. The state and local deduction, the increases in the state and local deduction that were not in the administration's proposal, but were inserted in the House of Representatives, are, I believe, misguided. They are retroactive, and the one thing we know is that retroactive tax increases don't have any positive incentive effects. They give relief to people like you and me who are not the people who really need help in our economy. I mean, there is something wrong. There is something deeply wrong with a Democratic revenue-raising measure that cuts the taxes of people like you and me who are almost certainly in the top 10th of 1% because we've been very lucky and fortunate of the income distribution. And we could make that better by scaling way back the state and local deduction proposal. And in the process of doing that, we would also reduce the inflationary pressure that would come from the bill.
So, Larry, it's clear to me, I think to everyone at this point, that many people have moved in your direction. You were very early on saying we're putting too much money in the fiscal stimulus in the last package. You're going to have inflation. We now have inflation without a doubt. But I wonder if you are that confident that everyone agrees with you that there's going to be overheating that really needs to be addressed right now. Because we do have some people. We talked to Paul Krugman. You and I talk about him regularly here. You know him well. I know you respect him. We talked to him this week, and he said, yes, absolutely, there's inflation. Yes, there should be tapering. But we've got two or three factors that make us less concerned about it. Number one is fiscal stimulus is working its way out necessarily. We're going to be contracting on the fiscal stimulus, given where we were. We've got a COVID out there that's undetermined. And in fact, the supply chain thing is getting better. So there are some people who think, yes, there's a problem, but it may solve itself to some extent.
Paul's been wishful thinking on this for 9 months, and I think he still is. With respect to the fiscal policy, we've still got very substantial levels of spending to come from the fiscal policy we've already done, and we've got new fiscal legislation that'll increase the deficit by $160 billion in the legislation if it's not amended in the Senate. The forecasts, which call for continued reductions of a substantial magnitude in unemployment, even given the super high vacancy rate, so further tightening, already assume all that Paul is saying about the fiscal policy. So I think he's pretty unlikely to turn out to be right in his fiscal policy argument. And excuse me, David, what was the other argument that you cited?
COVID.
Oh, look, nobody knows what's going to happen about COVID. What's kind of remarkable about people like Paul and some of the others who have just, I think, been deniers and hopers on this is that if COVID's bad, they think that's a reason for more stimulus because we need to support the economy through COVID. And if COVID's good and goes away, they think that's a reason for more stimulus because we're going to get more supply. And they try to have it every which way.
Thank you so much, Larry. Always a treat to have you with us. That's Larry Summers of Harvard.
That does it for this episode of Wall Street Week. I'm David Westin. This is Bloomberg. See you next week.